Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
A day to remember the worker who did not come home from his or her job. It's the toll of neglect. And today on the show, the Government Affairs Director, the AFL-CIO, and 146 people who will never forget. Welcome to the Thursday, April 28th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on a number of platforms and growing, just to name a few: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. We have two guests on the show today. This being the last Thursday of the month, that means Mr. Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the Labor Federation, AFLCIO.org, for complete updates. He's going to be our first guest. We're going to talk about what is happening and what is not happening in Congress. Build back better. Now, we've been talking about this on the show for months on end. And from all indications, there's going to be pieces, parts that they're moving forward on. In fact, we were talking yesterday with Pete Almeida on behalf of the heat and frost insulators. And there's a tax incentive package for mechanical insulation that they may try to get through. And we'll see what else is on the table. We'll also touch on the PRO Act, because in Build Back Better, there were components of the PRO Act. That's the Protect the Right to Organize. Imagine if we had the PRO Act today, how much more organizing there'd be going on. Because the figures show at the NLRB, there's a big bump in organizing. Even Fox News did a story on this the other day. They said, what's going on with all these people that want a union? It's kind of funny. We'll talk about the competes bill. This is a really good piece of legislation. I know the steelworkers are pushing it really hard. And in essence, what this legislation would do would provide not millions, but billions of dollars in direct investments essential to preserving our critical industrial infrastructure. All right? Industrial infrastructure. And this is exactly what China does. They support their industries. They pour tons of money into their industries to make sure they're state of the art. We don't do the same here. And as a result, we're falling behind. We'll talk about the changes at the NLRB, Joy Silk Doctrine, also some revolutionary rulings from the general counsel, Jennifer Abruzzo, who comes from the CWA. So we'll touch on that and more. And today is Workers' Memorial Day. I have some numbers on that I'll get to. I'm sure Bill will reflect on that as well. Mary Ann Trishotti will be joining us later in the show. And for various reasons, again, this is Workers' Memorial Day. And she is with a coalition. A little background on her. She's a professor at Hofstra University of Rhetoric and Public Advocacy. She's also the director of Labor Studies. And she is president of the Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. We've talked about this on the show many, many times. Happened in 1911 in New York City. 123 women, 23 men died when a fire broke out. And there's various angles we're going to get into. Number one, I had a good conversation yesterday with Tim Coleman on behalf of the sprinkler fitters. Tim's all over the country. And I'll tell you, he's going to be providing some really good guests, because the United Association is really ramping up right now with a lot of production that's happening at various plants. Intel, for one. That's another subject. But when you talk about sprinkler fitters, imagine if they had sprinkler fitters working that building back in 1911 and fire stopping. We wouldn't be talking about 146 people dying. So what Mary Ann, she's going to touch on that, but she's going to talk about this coalition that she's involved with. And they're hoping that sometime next year, they will have enough resources to put this memorial together. And she started organizing this back in 2010. And they think by next year, which would be 2023, it would be dedicated. And here's the significance. It'll be the first labor memorial and one of only a handful of memorials to women in New York City. You get an opportunity. Just Google Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. There's a lot posted there. There's pictures. And I'll tell you, the stories are amazing of the people in that era who watched this horror. And again, one of the people that watched it later became the first woman, first female, as Secretary of Labor. And that was in the Roosevelt administration, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in the 1930s. So Marianne is going to be our second guest right here on America's Workforce. Well, as I indicated, today is Workers' Memorial Day. And it's, why is it today? Well, it's because on this day, April 28th, in 1970, the Occupational Safety and Health Act went into effect 51 years ago, promising every worker the right to a safe job. More than 647,000 workers now can say that their lives have been saved since passage of that act. And since that time, workplace safety and health conditions have improved, let's be honest, but too many workers remain at serious risk of injury, illness, or death. And you got various problems, chemical plant explosions, major fires, construction collapses, infectious disease outbreaks, workplace assaults, and other preventable workplace tragedies. Workplace hazards kill and disable approximately 125,000 workers each year. 4,764 from traumatic injuries, and an estimated 120,000 from occupational diseases. So you're working on your job, you could be getting sick and you don't even know it, like asbestos. 20, 30, 40 years later, you die from that. Job injury and illness numbers continue to be severe undercounts of the real problem. So the Death on the Job report, if you go to AFL-CIO.org, you can download this report, and there's a lot to read. It's 256 pages. It's called The Toll of Neglect. It's the 31st year that the Labor Federation has produced a report on the state and safety of health protections for American workers. And I glanced through it yesterday. There's a lot packed in there, state by state. And we were talking last week about the state of Arizona. And they have such a weak department for occupational safety and health. They've got, you ready for this? One inspector for every 138,000 workers. The national average, which is also weak, the national average is one inspector for every 82,881 workers. You know what that comes out to budget-wise? Because the budget for OSHA has been slashed over the years. I mean, it's so sad because you should know by now that worker safety takes a back seat unless your union is doing something about it. And I could speak about the trades and how they put safety first. I mean, we record this show day in and day out at the Iron Workers Hall, Local 17 in Cleveland, Ohio. I see what these guys are doing for training. It's amazing. It's amazing. Wouldn't it be great if that kind of safety training was done across all of America? You know what it is right now? What they're spending? $4.37 to protect each worker covered under the Occupational Safety Act. That's ridiculous. It is getting better. Under the Trump administration, there was very little attention paid to safety. It was all, okay, the companies can handle that. Corporations can handle that. Mm-hmm. President Biden, and this is all contained in the AFL-CIO report, Biden has appointed and nominated strong candidates focused on worker protection to lead job safety and health agencies and labor agencies. immediately upon taking office, he appointed a longtime United Steelworkers safety and health leader. That would be James Frederick, as acting assistant secretary for occupational safety and health. A year ago, April 2021, the Senate confirmed Marty Walsh, the Boston mayor from the construction trades, as secretary of labor. Then in April 2021, Biden nominated Doug Parker to be assistant secretary of labor for occupational safety and health and head of OSHA. Parker served as the California OSHA chief on the Biden-Harris transition team in chief policy roles at the Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA, and was executive director of WorkSafe, a nonprofit organization focused on workplace injury, illness, and death prevention. So we're getting the right people in place, and you know we're moving a mountain on this one. You have to know that. But I urge you, when you get an opportunity, to go to AFL-CIO.org. It's right on the homepage, and click on that report, The Toll of Neglect. And they do this each and every year. They've been doing it for over 30 years. And it's an eye-opener. It really is. You know, I just mentioned Doug Parker, who comes from the Mine Safety Administration. Well, we've got some news about Warrior Met. Warrior Met Coal held its annual shareholders meeting on Tuesday of this week as 900 members of the Mine Workers, United Mine Workers Association, are still on strike over a year for a fair contract. More than a year ago, these members walked off the job in Alabama to demand a just agreement from their employer that recognizes their contributions to the coal company's profits. Well, get this. The union estimates that Warrior Met lost $1 billion in potential revenue last year because of their refusal to bargain for a fair agreement. So the members and their supporters across the labor movement have taken to social media to ask a simple question. How can a company care so little about its workers, the Alabama community, and its shareholders all at the same time? I don't understand. They have their shareholders meeting, and this is a hedge fund that bought the company some years back. Don't you think they'd be interested in profits? How do you lose $1 billion and face your shareholders? That's the question. We're still on this story. In fact, we've got a segment with the mine workers coming up in the next couple of weeks. But this is crazy. It's absolutely crazy. I don't understand how they can continue this strike as long as they're continuing it. All right, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, Bill Samuel of the AFL-CIO.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
This segment of America's Workforce is brought to you by Survey and Ballot Systems. SBS has been providing unions with secure and flexible election options for over 30 years. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters. We care for our nation's veterans, and we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers, and we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at AFGE.org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO.
American workers are the best in the world, but we face an uphill battle against countries like China that don't play by the rules. There's a bill right now in Congress that would give American workers the trade tools we need to fight back and win. Join me in telling Congress to pass this bill. Visit AmericanManufacturing.org to learn how.
Paid for by the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the United Labor Agency. They connect people with employment, good employment, I might add. You can find more at ulagency.org. Got a footnote here to Workers' Memorial Day. I was talking about this a few minutes ago, and I mentioned Marty Walsh and what he and his team has done for worker safety in the past year. I mean, this guy's amazing what he put forward in the short time that he's been Secretary of Labor. Well, today at 1 o'clock, they did a commemorance at the department's headquarters in Washington. And Doug Parker, the guy I talked about who came from the Mine Safety Administration, was at that ceremony. And they had remarks from various guests, including a coal miner at the Sago Mine in West Virginia, where an explosion and collapse claimed the lives of his 12 workers. That was back in 2006. There was also a person, Renee Harrison, whose son was fatally injured. This goes back 4 years ago, 2018, at a Massachusetts construction site. So again, I urge you to go to the AFL-CIO website, AFLCIO.org, and do check out that report, The Toll of Neglect. It's an eye-opener. It really is. Liz Schuler made a comment this week, too, about Workers' Memorial today, and she said, "We are recommitting to our fight for safe workplaces for every worker. We will keep going until we know no one has to risk their life for a paycheck. And until we have the laws we need to allow every worker to organize for improved working conditions without fear of retaliation from their employer." Boy, you know, a lot of that goes on. All right. Speaking of the AFL-CIO, let's go to our live line right now. Joining us from Washington, as he does each and every month, Mr. Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the AFL-CIO. Mr. Samuel, how are we doing today, brother?
We're doing okay. Thanks for having me on.
Good, good, good. Yeah, it's a solemn day. A solemn day, no doubt about it. I'm sure it's that way at the AFL-CIO, along with many union halls today, commemorating those who got up in the morning, had their breakfast, and didn't make it home. They were killed on the job.
Way too many families affected by this. You know, it's about 5,000 workers a year die on the job unnecessarily or needlessly. And we have a reinvigorated OSHA, as you said, with under Doug Parker and Secretary Marty Walsh, but they've got a ways to go. It's been hollowed out by Republican administrations over decades. And so we have a ways to go.
They got to do a better job of funding OSHA too, because the ratio for inspectors at workplaces is ridiculous. It's one inspector for like 83,000 workers, and it's even worse in Arizona. Arizona's horrible right now.
Right, but, right. I mean, you know, the economy grows, the workforce grows, and agencies that are supposed to protect workers haven't kept up, like OSHA and the Mine Safety and Health Administration and other critical federal programs that are supposed to protect workers and families, as you said, when they get up and go to work in the morning. Mostly under Republican Congresses, they've tried to, they've been cutting budgets. They just haven't allowed these agencies to keep up with the growth in work and the workload.
All right, let's talk about what's happening in Congress. They're back in session. And in fact, I saw a story just this week that Joe Manchin is trying to reach out to Republicans on getting some legislation passed in dealing with climate change. I don't know the specifics on it. I'm sure you do. What's the status right now?
Well, you know, this goes back to the original Biden administration's economic agenda, which included dealing with climate change by transitioning our economy to greener energy, renewable fuels, but also dealing with uncapped wells and mines that continue to pollute, but in a way that provides a transition for workers in the fossil sector. So it's meant to keep people at work, but slowly transition, training workers for new jobs, for electric vehicles, again, for renewable electricity. And that's going to take some money and some time. And I think Biden had it right when it's not going to be overnight. But we do have a climate crisis. I think you'd have to be, your head would have to be in the firmly placed in the sand not to know that. And so that's what this was the Build Back Better agenda that the president talked about back in January, the State of the Union. And Manchin has picked up on that. You know, he comes from a coal-producing state. Obviously, West Virginia is dependent, heavily dependent on fossil fuels. And there are a lot of other states in the, producing oil and gasoline and dependent on fossil energy. And the Build Back Better initiative of the president's, again, put a lot of money into slowly transitioning, protecting workers at the same time and their communities. And Manchin, I think wants to get back to that. You know, Build Back Better, with big economic program, was looked like it was dead back in December. I think Manchin is going to help revive it. And that's our hope, at least for over the next 60 days, I'd say.
So it's not going to be pieces, parts then? They're just maybe going to trim it down, but it's still going to be a package? Is that what I'm hearing?
I think that's right. I mean, they're Democrats. You know, this gets into the nitty-gritty of legislating, but the Democrats only have one chance to pass a bill with 50 votes, not subject to a filibuster and the 60-vote threshold, and that's called reconciliation. It's when they deal with the annual budget. So they still haven't passed this reconciliation bill. There's basically one per year, and it's part of the budget process, and they can put a lot of things into it. And one of the things that the president, I think, very cleverly thought of late last year was, let's use reconciliation to pass my entire economic package. Now, it was much bigger than energy when he first proposed it. It included paid family and medical leave, free community college, lots of health care and education improvements, and energy was among them. So investing in renewable energy and the transition, as I said, to a cleaner energy future. So the cleaner energy part is something Joe Manchin likes, and he's the 50th vote. He may not like some of these other items, or may think they don't belong in reconciliation, you know, that they should pass separately. So we're just going to have to, we have to get Joe Manchin, frankly, and that's not an easy task. He's a, he's a thoughtful legislator. He represents a pretty conservative state. West Virginia went heavily for Donald Trump, but he is willing to back part of the president's package. And as I said, there's only one chance to get a bill across the finish line with 50 votes. So we're going to have to, the president's going to have to sit down with him and figure out what can go in that package. And I think there's still a shot at getting it done. And I think it'll be focused mostly on energy. He also would like to see some prescription drug pricing reforms that could make it in this package. And some tax reform. I think you have to appreciate the fact that Joe Manchin wants to raise the corporate tax rate and the minimum tax on millionaires. So that'll pay for some of this. And those are good proposals even on their own.
And Manchin's in favor of that, the increase in
and
the
Manchin
tax.
Manchin is in favor of that. He said he is. Again, the Senate is stuck without all 50 Democrats being on the same page. And so they have a relatively diverse caucus, everybody from Bernie Sanders on the left to Joe Manchin, more to the right. They've got to get every one of them. They've got to go all right. 50. I'm sure your listeners have been watching this chaos all year. Just confirming the president's cabinet took months. They haven't confirmed everybody he's nominated for various political jobs because they have to get at least 50 votes. And there are only 50 Democrats, and Republicans have not been playing ball and cooperating. It's been a really tough session.
I want to get into some of the specifics on those nominations, but first I want to get into some legislation here. And in fact, we've been having various conversations with Scott Paul at the Alliance for American Manufacturing. You know him. And yep. They're pushing this Bipartisan Innovation Act. And then there's this other piece of legislation, the Competes Act. I don't know which one you want to start with here, but apparently with the Innovation Act, there's some stuff they're trying to meld from the House version into the Senate. Let's just start there. What do you know about that?
Yeah, so there's two bills. There's two bills, and it was originally called the China Competition Bill. When the Senate finished it, the U.S. Competition Innovation Act, USICA. It leaned a little bit in the direction of sort of where corporate America wanted to take it. So we weren't that happy with the Senate version. Now, there were some good things in it. big funding increases for the National Science Foundation to, you know, get a move a little quicker on research and innovation into new technologies, again, clean energy, U.S. supply chains, manufacturing, a lot of money devoted to that. You know, we're falling behind. Some countries spend a lot of money and are very dedicated to increasing their manufacturing and research and development. We're kind of slow on that. So the Senate took this up. Again, we weren't as thrilled with that version of it because some of the trade decisions, on trade they made toward the end. The House then passed what they call the Competes Act, and they're going to try to put them together in a conference committee starting next week. And the Competes Act, we think, is really pretty good. It's about $250 billion to increase U.S. manufacturing capabilities, including $50 billion to support semiconductor manufacturing. That sounds pretty technical, but most products we make now involve semiconductors, cars, for example, and we're running short on them. So we have to reignite U.S. Semiconductor production. Most of it has gone overseas. The solar industry, most of that has gone overseas. We need to get that back. Even critical medical supplies, much of that we were relying on China in the early days of the pandemic, you may recall. So a lot of this is meant to bring this production back to the U.S. It's a lot of money. They've got to put these two bills together and make it work. And we're pretty optimistic that this may be one of the bills they get across the finish line. And this will take 60 votes. You know, the Senate can filibuster this bill, Senate Republicans, but they seem to be on board right now. So we may get a bipartisan package at the end of the day.
Okay, Bill. So with all that you said right now, it sounds optimistic. Is anybody putting a timetable on any of this? I know, you know, we got the midterm elections coming. Can we get this done by then? I guess that's my question.
Oh, yeah, I think we can. I think the both chambers have now passed their versions of this bill. So we've got two bills in conference, the House and Senate. Now it's going to be a long conference because they're different, and there's still a lot of animosity between Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill. But they both passed it. The Senate with I think a dozen or more Republican votes, so it was bipartisan over there. It was not as bipartisan in the House. I think only one or two Republicans in the House voted for this bill, but they're in conference now. And I think they'll get they'll reach an agreement probably in the next month. I think by the August recess, so that means May, June, July, they'll be in conference. And I think they will get this done. It'll be great for U.S. manufacturing, put a lot of people to work, and really give us the kind of head start we need to catch up to China and other advanced countries that have been spending a lot of money on research and development and taking a lot of our industries offshore. This hopefully will bring those jobs back.
Yeah. Well, I know a lot of Republicans right now are coming down on China. Finally, at first they weren't,
that's right.
But they're coming down on them. So here's an opportunity to fix the problem. I mean, it's real simple.
Exactly. Put partisanship aside, get to work in this conference committee and get a product that both sides can vote for.
Yeah, I just want to drive our listeners to Scott Paul's website, and that's the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org. He's doing a really good campaign to get everybody ready, lobby all the troops. Those of you listening right now, we're on six different platforms. Tell your member of Congress to pass the Bipartisan Innovation Act and move America forward. That's what this is all about. All right, Bill, I got to take a quick break here. Bill Samuel joining us on our live line, Government Affairs Director of the Labor Federation. Later in the show, we're going to talk about the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York City. Mary Ann Trescotti will be joining us, and she is working on a memorial they're hoping to dedicate next year. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to AFLCIO.org.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, we are available on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis, and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings, so keep them coming. Let's go back to our live line. Joining us from Washington, as he does each and every month, Mr. Bill Samuel, Government Affairs Director of the Labor Federation. All right, let's get into the National Labor Relations Board. And I'll tell you, it's a refreshing change, no doubt about that. Jennifer Abruzzo, General Counsel, is making some really interesting rulings, and I know she's riling up a lot of conservatives in Washington. I'm sure you're getting an earful on that one. But just to run down some of the things that are changing, go ahead.
Yeah, well, this is really some of the better news for workers under the Biden administration. You know, elections do have consequences, and one of the things that happens is the president gets to name to important boards and commissions people that he thinks should serve, and they do have to get confirmed by the Senate, most of them, and the NLRB is no exception. So the Senate did very narrowly approve Jennifer Abruzzo's nomination at the beginning of the Biden administration, and she has just been on fire. She is really rethinking the way the National Labor Relations Board operates for the first time in decades. I mean, this is the agency that was created in the 1930s when the National Labor Relations Act was first passed when Roosevelt was president. Now Jennifer's taking sort of a fresh look at things, and she's bringing really much needed energy to the board. And a couple of the areas that she's looking at now are these so-called captive audience meetings, which have been just exploding in the corporate world when they're trying to squash union organizing. We've heard about it at AFSCME at Amazon and Starbucks and other organizing drives, where the companies get to pull workers aside, put them in a room, basically interrogate them, follow them around. If there are truckers, they sit in the cab with them, and they do everything they can to indoctrinate them against the union. Those are so-called captive audience meetings. They're legal, but only to the extent that the board says they're legal. And now Jennifer Bruiser was saying, you know what? Those are inherently coercive. And under the National Labor Relations Act, coercive behavior is not legal when workers are trying to freely choose a union. So she's asked her regional staff around the country to take another look at something that has been going on and getting worse, frankly, over the decades. And she's saying it's time we put a stop to it. So administratively, they may outlaw captive audience meetings. I think that's a huge change in American business, and particularly the union busting side of American business. So that's one thing she's doing, and it's a really hopeful sign.
Bill, you mentioned Amazon. I know in one facility, the one I believe it was in Staten Island, which voted 55% to go union, they were spending $3,000 a day. $3,000 a day to the union busters. I mean,
they spend millions of dollars across the country. That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Just individual people making that kind of money, and they're attracting
right.
them. But they still beat that. In fact, there's a vote going on at another warehouse this week. We might have the results here in the next couple of days.
What it takes to overcome that is really heroic on the part of workers, and we saw that in Staten Island.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, one more thing here, and that's you mentioned this before in the first segment, the nominations, judiciary, executive branch. Can you be specific? What's being held up right now, Bill?
Well, it's just taking forever. I mean, we're well into the second year of the Biden administration, and they still haven't been able to fill these critical jobs, even at the Department of Labor. We don't have a confirmed wage and hour administrator, you know, the person who's responsible in the federal government for making sure that companies aren't stealing wages or that they're not paying, they're paying properly for overtime, minimum wage. The Republicans have really dragged out every single nomination. You know, there's, I think there's a couple thousand political appointees. It's not just the, you know, 15 cabinet members. There are political appointees throughout the government who run these programs. So at the Department of Labor, for example, you've got a whole tier of people who are have to be approved by the Senate at just beneath the secretary. And many of those positions are still not filled, or they're filled by temporary employees, and the Republicans are insisting on, you know, debating, taking 30 hours, I think that's the current Senate rule, on every single one of them. So the administration is probably not, you know, after 4 years, they're not going to have everybody confirmed if we, if the Republicans insist on if they continue this behavior for the next 2.5 years. So, and it's the same with the federal judiciary. You know, there are always vacancies occurring on the district, federal district courts, circuit, the courts of appeal. The one thing that gets attention, of course, is the Supreme Court, and the Republicans, you know, have, you know, when they're in charge, they ram those through. And when the Democrats are in charge, you put everything aside. And we got Ketanji Brown Jackson confirmed, you know, a few weeks back. But the rest of the federal government is still, you know, full of vacancies. And that's been a problem. And it just slows down the administration getting things done. They don't have ambassadors confirmed in countries around the world.
Amazing. Just amazing what they're doing to slow things down. You know, the Ketanji Brown Jackson, the polling indicates, and this is heartwarming to know that the American public thought what the conservatives, the Republicans did. And there was just a few, Josh Hawley for one. And there was a couple others that just beat her up ridiculously.
They said,
yeah, Ted Cruz, they went too far. They went too far. They basically made up stuff. And the American public called them out on that. So at least people are recognizing the politics in this country today has gotten so ugly that, I mean, it's grinding government to a halt. And I know some like that. I mean, they want government to go away. I mean, there's people that say, you got to drown it in a bathtub. You got to defund everything. It's crazy. But
yeah, I think the American people showed a basic sense of fairness around those hearings. And I think she was, I think that most Americans felt she was really unfairly attacked. And that's a good sign that Americans can still tell right from wrong in those situations.
All right. We'll leave it on that note. You take care, my fellow union brother, and keep up the fight in Washington. I know it's not easy. And I'm sure you'll have a complete update coming up in May, okay?
Look forward to it. Thanks.
All right, we're going to take a quick break right now. When we come back, Marianne Trescotti on the Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition. We'll talk about that and how it reflects on workers' Memorial Day. Back in a few minutes.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's L-I-U-N-A.
The Heat and Frost Insulators and Allied Workers are proud to be a title sponsor for America's Workforce Radio. The Insulators Union is leading the way in the mechanical insulation industry, fire stopping, and infectious disease control. Regarded as North America's energy conservation specialist, these professionals are known for their professional work and dedication. You can learn more about the Insulators Union at insulators.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the Ohio Federation of Teachers. You can find more at oh.aft.org. And we got a bit of a teaching lesson today. We're going to go back into time. Joining us on line number two right now is Mary Ann Trishotti. And she is with a coalition called the Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition. Their website is rememberthetrianglefire.org. Mary Ann is professor of rhetoric and public advocacy and director of labor studies at Hofstra University. And as I indicated, she's also president of this coalition, and they're trying to dedicate this next year. It'll be the first labor memorial and one of only a handful of memorials to women in New York City. 146 people died in that tragic fire. 123 of them were women, mostly immigrants. Mary Ann, welcome back to America's Workforce. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
And this is something that affected you. I was reading earlier on. In fact, I want to read the poem that inspired you. This is some years back. I'll do that at the end of our segment today. But this fire, I mean, if you think about in today's standards, and I had a great conversation yesterday with Tim Coleman. You know Tim from the Sprinkler Fitters, which is part of the United Association. They didn't have sprinkler systems in buildings back then. And you, if you think about that, I mean, that was a different time in American history. Fire stopping is another one. And these are all professions that unions work on. They're highly skilled. They're trained to save lives in these buildings. And when you reflect back at 1911, it's, oh my gosh, it's mind-blowing. It's sad. But it was also a game changer. And I want to talk about that. Well, that was kind of a catalyst for change. Let's start there, Mary Ann. Go ahead.
Yeah, and you're right. Many of the things that keep us safe in our homes and our workplaces and public spaces generally didn't exist in 1911. And things like mandatory fire drills and maximum occupancy limits and fire extinguishers and all those things, you're absolutely right. And one of the reasons that we have them now is because of the Triangle Fire. I mean, people were just horrified at what they saw. These young workers, some of them as young as 14, most of them women and girls, some of them in the U.S. for less than a year. They came primarily from Eastern Europe and Italy, Southern Italy, Sicily and Southern Italy. And it was just awful. And it really motivated people to push for change, politicians, but also working people. You know, they organized and demanded better. And they got it. And that's, I think, a really important lesson of the fire.
Well, Mary Ann, as you indicated, a lot of people watched this in horror. But one of them in particular was Frances Perkins, who later became the Secretary of Labor. In fact, the first female Secretary of Labor under FDR. Can you tell us that story and how that, I guess, that got the ball rolling, did it not?
Yeah, it's one of the things that got the ball rolling. Frances Perkins at the time was a young social worker, and Washington Square Park, which is just west of the Brown Building, which was at the time called the Ash Building, which is the building where the fire happened, right on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors. It's just near Washington Square Park, which was a kind of a swanky neighborhood then, and as it is now, and Perkins was having tea with a friend and heard this commotion and saw smoke, and she rushed over to the site, and along with a number of other people, watched in horror as over 50 young women and some men jumped out of the windows to avoid being burned to death, and as others were trapped inside. And it really changed her. She was already a good person and a committed consumer advocate. She became, as a result of the fire, she became active in the factory investigating committee, which New York State set up to travel around and visit workplaces and inquire about safety and sanitary conditions and labor conditions. And Perkins was really involved in that. And then, yes, eventually went on to become the first female cabinet member. She was FDR's Secretary of Labor. When she agreed to take the job, she brought a list of policy changes that she wanted to see enacted. Most of them were achieved as part of the New Deal. And on the 50th anniversary of the fire, she did say that the New Deal began on March 25th, 1911. So not only fire extinguishers and maximum occupancy limits and all of those other obvious safety features, but the New Deal itself is a legacy of the Triangle Fire. So it's really had a profound influence on many, many facets of U.S. society.
So we're talking radical changes here. And I have to ask you, I know you study history a lot. Did she get a lot of pushback? I mean, there was a lot of things happening back in the 30s. I mean, you think about the New Deal, you think about Social Security, National Labor Relations Act, things like that. But what happened? I mean, you know, there were people saying, oh, wait a minute, we don't have to go that far. We don't have to do that, do we?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to remember that the New Deal was always contested, right? So for every step forward, there were people pushing for two steps back. That's absolutely true. I mean, that's how we end up with the Taft-Hartley law, right? People, business interests thought that the National Labor Relations Act went too far, right, in recognizing the rights of workers to organize and picket and protest and boycott. And so they pushed back against those rights. And that's always the case, right? I think what we need to remember, what the Triangle Fire teaches us, is that change is possible. And certainly when good people like Frances Perkins in government make change, it's terrific. But also working people have to keep pushing for union representation, for safe workplaces, and the struggle never ends. Every law that's passed could be a law that's repealed or amended. And I think that is just as much part of our lesson from the New Deal as anything else, which is that just because we get these laws passed doesn't mean they're necessarily enforced or that they can't be threatened. Yeah. And so absolutely, it was contested and it remains contested. And we need to, constantly recommit ourselves to not only protecting it, but expanding the protections of the New Deal so that everyone has a safe workplace and the rights that workers should all enjoy.
Mary Ann, I have to ask you, today is Workers' Memorial Day. Is there anything going on at the site, at that area in New York, that might commemorate what happened in 1911?
Actually, the site is a construction site right now. As you mentioned at the beginning of the segment, we are in the final stretch of a campaign to build a memorial and install it on this landmarked building. Over 100 years later, there is no memorial. There are some plaques, and people walk right by and don't even notice. So if you're at the corner of Washington and Green Street today, you will see a construction site. You will soon see a sign that says Future Site of the Triangle Memorial. We do commemorate the fire on its honor about its anniversary date every year, March 25th. This year, we, along with the New York City Central Labor Council, engage in a kind of a general commemoration of all workers who have died on the job.
Yeah, I get it. Well, let's talk about that memorial. It's funny, too, you mentioned about the struggle for workers and workers' rights. Well, it was a struggle to get this thing going. I know you started, what was it, in 2010 to get this memorial. Can you walk us through how difficult this was?
Oh, my gosh, how much time do we have? It's been over a dozen years. It started before the centennial of the fire. Remember, the Triangle Fire Coalition had this really good idea. We'll plan, we'll help organize centennial events, and we'll build a memorial. Well, each of those is a huge undertaking. So I took over the memorial project, and it started kind of under in the shadow of the centennial, which is absolutely appropriate. And we had a really big event, brought a lot of people to the site of the fire, and also brought a lot of awareness of this really important moment in U.S. history. And then once that wound down, we really started building momentum towards the memorial. We have received a significant grant from the state of New York, so I'm delighted that New York State sees fit to support this project. In 2015, we were awarded $1.5 million to cover the cost of building it and attaching it to the Brown Building. We're working with NYU, which owns the building. It's an NYU science building, so we've got this really great collaborative relationship, but it took a while to work that out. We have this kind of public-private partnership thing going, and it's been really terrific. But during COVID, when everything slowed down, we did a number of tests on the building, which we would have done anyway, and we thought, all right, now we can sort of do them at our leisure because not much else is happening. And we found out that because this building is over 100 years old, it's got some mysteries to it, and we had to rethink the way we were going to attach the memorial to the building. And that rethinking of how the memorial would be attached has led to a upward revision of the budget. So we now need to raise about $950,000 to deal with those issues that are related to the structure of the building itself and the need to make it safe to have a memorial attached to it. So we are raising money for that. But the city, you know, every entity in the city that has a say in this is completely on board. The Landmarks Preservation Commission, the Community Board, the New York City Council, all of our city reps. So it's really great to have the support, the Central Labor Council, Italian-American, Jewish-American organizations, the firefighters. It's just a matter of coming up with that last bit of money that we need to get us over the finish line.
Almost $1 million. Are you confident you can raise that money in time for next year?
I am confident, yes. We have a number of really dedicated people. We're all, or nearly all of us, who are actually working with the coalition are volunteers. I mean, we have hired experts to fabricate and build this memorial, but the coalition itself is an all-volunteer organization, and we're just not stopping until this happens. I mean, these young women and girls and the young men who died in the fire, they really deserve tribute. The movements that are emerged afterward for workers' rights and worker justice and safety really deserve to be celebrated. The hard work of everyone after the fire really needs to be lifted up, and we are going to do that. New York City needs a labor memorial. We call ourselves a union town, and we don't have a labor memorial, so we're going to change that. And we are looking for contributions of every size. Everyone who donates will be recognized. Anyone who donates $25,000 or more will have their name on the building, on a plaque. And we are looking to fill that plaque and get that thing built, and we will do it. Absolutely. I have no doubt.
I take it people can donate on your website, rememberthetrianglefire.org. Can they do that?
Yes, they can. rememberthetrianglefire.org. And I welcome contributions of any size. Really, this memorial belongs to all of us. All of our lives have been affected by the Triangle Fire and its legacy in one way or another. And it's just the design itself. I encourage listeners to go to rememberthetrianglefire.org. Check out the images. It's a really powerful, very spare but powerful design. It names all the workers. It lists their ages. It tells the story of the fire. The text will be in English, Italian, and Yiddish, because those are the languages that most of the workers spoke, and provides eyewitness testimony as well. And I can't imagine that anyone who goes to see the memorial will not be moved by it. And we expect it's going to be a significant draw for the city because it's such a powerful story, and it really needs to be told 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Well, Mary Ann, we are very fortunate to have you behind us. You're the driving force. And again, Mary Ann Cerciati. And she is the president of the Remember the Triangle Fire Coalition, that website, if you want to help out, because they're trying to get this done next year. All right. RememberTheTriangleFire.org. RememberTheTriangleFire.org on this Workers' Memorial Day. Mary Ann, thank you so much for joining us, and keep the faith, and let's stay in touch on this so we can get this done. All right.
I would love to. And I hope we're doing another interview a year from now talking about how great the dedication of the memorial was.
Absolutely. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, we'll unwind the teachers' strike in Minneapolis and the latest from IBEW Local 1220. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.